You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Hello, welcome to Shared Planet, the series that's exploring the relationship between the increasing human population and the natural world. Now, what does the cry of a curlew over an expanse of windswept estuary evoke for you? How valuable and rich an experience is it? For the great Irish poet W.B. Yeats, the response was this poem. O curlew, cry no more in the air, or only to the water in the west, because your crying brings to my mind passion-dimmed eyes and long, heavy hair that was shaken out over my breast. There is enough evil in the crying of the wind. Nature certainly inspires poetry and every possible form of artistic expression, but it rarely summons the cold logic of the balance sheet. But should we be making a rational valuation of the natural world in all its various forms? Would it be the most practical way to decide how to spend our resources protecting it? In other words, should we be working out how much nature is worth? Or is this a heart-shrivelling reduction of all that we most love and value in nature? As the human population grows year on year, heading for 9 billion people by the middle of the century, all the resources we need now and in the future have to come from this one planet. How do we make sure that the natural world, nature's capital, is valued in the wider economic system? This is where environmental economics comes in. If we had to do that function ourselves, like to take an all too possible example, pollinating our fruit trees by hand because bees disappeared, then that would cost us a huge amount. Thus, the argument goes, we should put the services nature provides into our business calculations and not just take these ecosystem services, as they're called, for granted. And it follows that if conservationists can show that nature is worth saving in hard financial terms, then it has a better chance of being conserved. This puts nature squarely in the marketplace and articulates it in the language of the city trader rather than the poet. This is a controversial topic, and to guide us through it, I have with me in the studio Tony Juniper, environmentalist and writer who's just written a book, What Has Nature Ever Done For Us?, with the intriguing subtitle, How Money Really Does Grow on Trees, and also Bill Adams, Professor of Conservation and Development in the Department of Geography at the University of Cambridge. And, of course, our correspondent, Kelvin Boot. Now, Kelvin, how widely accepted is this idea of environmental economics, of putting a value on everything?
Well, generally, the feeling is that putting a price on nature is a good thing, but that it should be done so with caution. Some organisations feel there may be a risk of what's called commoditisation. Nature becomes a tradable asset. And there's a further risk, and that is that people will start to expect payment for looking after nature on their land, going along the lines of, if it's worth that much, you should give me a reward for caring for it. The RSPB, for example, told me that they felt it was necessary to put a price on nature because up to now we've put a zero value on it. And so when it comes to making decisions, when it comes to making policy, it is necessary to have some measure of value that the people making those decisions actually understand. But again, the RSPB makes the point very strongly that economic valuation must complement, not replace, the scientific or ethical reasons for nature conservation. On the other hand, the International Fund for Animal Welfare have used a financial argument to actually prove that whales in Japan are worth more as a tourist attraction than they are on a dinner plate. And globally, of course, whale watching is massive. It generates around $2 billion each year. And there are similar arguments that have been put forward for sharks in the Philippines. A piece of research published this week shows that the value of shark watching tourism will soar to nearly $800 million over the next 20 years. And that far outstrips the value of sharks as soup.
OK, thanks, Kelvin. And before we get into more detail, let's listen to our field report, which this week comes from St Andrews in Fife. A consortium of scientists working under an organisation called CBES, which stands for Coastal Biodiversity Ecosystem Sustainability, are working together to collect the data needed to put a value on the Eden estuary in the eastern Scottish coast. Estuaries and mudflats might be cold, muddy and boring, But they protect our coastlines. They filter water entering the sea, and they provide a breeding ground for many edible fish species, as well as providing a valuable source of food for many birds. But here, as in many places all over the world, coastlines are under threat from development, which can only increase as population rises. The work CBES is doing is still at the early stage of gathering information about the estuary. And so Trey Amfield went to meet Miriam Kaiwesh-Reeve, the CBES project leader, as the team began a day's work ankle-deep in mud.
This looks like a very impressive little barrow you've got here of techie kit. Take us through what you've got here.
This is the most sophisticated water pistol in the world. It's computer-controlled, so that the pulses are exact measurements of the pressure. We get some idea of
it's one of our most valuable measurements. It's called a contact core. So it's a small metal dish with a 2mm recess in the bottom, which we place into the sediment and then pour liquid nitrogen.
My laptop's connected to what's called a spectroradiometer, and this is looking at how much light is reflected from the sediment surface.
The range of hard science taking place on a small patch of soft mud was really quite impressive, and all of the different strands of data will fit together to build a bigger picture of the workings of the mudflat. From that, an assessment of its monetary value can be made. It seems strange to imagine the whole expanse of sediment, water and specialised plants as having a value that converts into pounds. But David Patterson, Professor of Coastal Ecology at the University of St Andrews and Director of the CBES Consortium, introduced me to some of the hidden residents of the salt marsh and explained the valuable functions that they perform.
Now these are amphipods. Then over here we have a worm. That's a polychaete worm known as Nereus and Hedysti.
He's about 5 centimetres long, greyish-black and almost flat, whereas these ones, which there are so many of once you look here.
Yes, that one you're pointing at there is a thing called Corophium volutator. And some people call them mud shrimps, but they're not really shrimps. It's a slightly different group. Now, you'll have to look hard for this one.
Tiny.
Tiny snail.
Or shell.
Yes, if you could just pick that up. That's Hydrobia ulvi, which is the small mud snail. And that's a very important organism. Again, there's a lot of them, and a lot of birds feed from them, as well as some of these other creatures as well. But the common thing they all have is that they live most of their lives in the sediment, in the sediment surfaces, and they form tubes and burrows. And these ones, the Corophium volutator, form U-shaped tubes in the sediment, and that helps oxygenate the surface layers. So the activity, and we call that activity, because it's by the organisms, bioturbation. So the organisms are turning the sediments over, they're introducing oxygen into them, and that's very important because it changes the whole biochemistry of the estuary. There are hundreds of millions of these organisms all around in the sediments that we're standing on at the moment, but the contribution they make is one of the things we're trying to measure. They help in being a foodstuff for the birds that come in and use this area. They turn over nutrients, they help oxygenate the sediment. All of these are recognised as small functions of the system that these organisms, which we encompass in the biodiversity of the whole system, help to contribute. And this project is really about trying to understand the links between the organisms that live in a habitat like this and the benefits that we take from it.
So although it's quite an overlooked habitat sometimes, it's not the most glamorous one, it is potentially of huge benefit to human beings.
Not many people go for a walk in a mudflat, but it's very productive. And in terms of the functions and services, one of the simplest to explain and can be seen around the coast of Britain is that we tend to build hard defences for protection against the sea. But nature's defence against the sea is a combination of these mudflat areas, beaches, salt marshes and sand dunes. And if you allow nature to establish its natural equilibrium, then it will take care of protecting the coast. But also if you have these extensive areas, then they support other populations. You can see some of the birds that are feeding on the surface of the mudflats here. The mudflats supply food to the fish populations that live in the estuary. And if we're still here in 4 hours, we'll be standing in a couple of metres of water, and the fish will be feeding from the surface of the sediments. So those are two of the most obvious services. The fact that these areas provide food, which helps support the local food chain and the food webs, and some of those are commercially important. But the other one that people can get an understanding of very quickly is the fact that they help moderate the force of the winds and the waves and help protect our inland habitats.
There are other benefits here too. All of this sticky mud is, ironically, superb at cleaning the environment.
The fact that these systems are fantastic filters, they capture nutrients and they transform them. They'll also capture compounds which are harmful in other ways, like heavy metals, etc., which are captured on the surface of all these sediment particles. And so this whole area acts as a filter for what's coming off the land and what's coming down the river. So keeping them healthy helps keep us healthy. And the real difficulty is putting a total value on that. It's easy to put a value on fisheries. It's perhaps easier to put a value on an area that's grazed, and then you can do the economics of the production of beef or wool or lamb. These other things are much harder to value, the nutrient turnover, the capture of pollutants. And then finally, there's the other value. Now, there are people who are walking along the coast, using it for recreation and for some leisure activities. How do you put a value on that? And that's very difficult.
To pick up on those points, Miriam Kaiwesh-Reeve, the CBES project officer, explained about the other less tangible but still valuable services the mudflats provide.
We, as people, enjoy looking at birds, and so we can put a monetary value on our enjoyment of looking at birds. And then equally, you'll have family groups, friends in formal gatherings, kind of salt marsh, mudflat areas, because that there is wildlife and it's easy to see. And all of these people have spent money at some level to get here and to enjoy that environment. So that's the first way that we're going to be looking at the kind of monetary valuation of the area. And then the second way, we'll be looking at the different types of people that use the salt marsh and mudflat area for recreation. So this will vary from someone walking their dog or going for a run along the kind of salt marsh mudflat boundary to maybe kite surfers, canoeists, kayakers, model aeroplane flyers. So all of these people are enjoying this environment for whatever reason. And so we're looking to understand the type of value that they place on these areas.
When it comes down to it, basically, it's how much people are spending in monetary terms to spend time here. That's what the value comes down to, is it?
It does in part, yes. So people will be going in their cars, buying fuel, maybe they'll be catching a bus, maybe they'll be paying an entrance fee, especially if it's, say, a nature reserve or it's on private land. But then at the same time, they'll also be spending money on kit. So a kite surfer is going to be spending a lot more money on their equipment compared to, say, maybe a jogger or a dog walker. So we're also looking to understand that. How much are people willing to pay to enjoy what they love to do in a natural space?
That was Miriam Kaiwesh-Reeve from CBES, ending Trey Anfield's report from the Eden Estuary in Scotland. Now, that seemed very efficient and in many ways straightforward. So earlier I asked Jonathan Aylin, a senior lecturer at Manchester Business School, how environmental economics is viewed by the business community.
I think there's one great advantage of this notion of ecosystem services, as it's sometimes called, to value nature. And that's a recognition that nature is a scarce resource. The ecosystem, if you like, is a capital asset in its own right. And in that respect, it's very similar to business, because just as a business needs to maintain its capital stock, it needs to repair and replace machinery and maintain buildings, so we have to maintain the natural capital stock intact. I think there's a fundamental flaw in all this. The building block of ecosystem services is people's willingness to pay for the services of nature. And if you like, people are, say, very willing to pay for birds. The RSPB is one of the biggest charities in Britain and perhaps one of the most powerful lobbies. We all watch Springwatch. But those same people are certainly not willing to pay for mud shrimps and mud snails and lugworms. They'd probably be revolted by them. Yet the central point is it's precisely those grubs and bugs that the birds depend upon for their livelihood. So you can't pick and choose the part of the ecosystem you prefer. You have to take it as an interdependent whole.
We're talking about paying for things that are attractive or give pleasure or recreation. But there are lots of things, such as pollinators, for example, that are absolutely essential for goods and services that are traded. Should they not be included as part of that market force?
Well, the great issue about ecosystem services is that it does remind us of all these services that nature provides. And you rightly say that some are very attractive. They're aesthetically appealing. They're cultural services, if you like. There are some that support us all by building up the soil. There are some that provide us with food. Some of these things are very easy to value. Some are very difficult, such as the way in which an estuary might clean out heavy metals. The difficulty is in any way partitioning an ecosystem when it is actually an interdependent system. You can't buy one or value one and then discard the other because, for instance, people aren't willing to pay for it.
Do you think that ecosystem economics is going to catch on? Do you think it will become widely accepted by world business?
I think the central problem is that it's a magnificent slogan, but it's very hard to put into practice. There's a great deal of talk about ecosystem services, and in many ways it's been extremely valuable, for instance, in establishing a baseline of what we've actually got out there in the way of a natural environment. What makes it difficult and almost intractable are placing monetary values on all these key items, these hidden items, these parts of the interconnected system.
It seems to me that what you're saying is nice idea, can't work.
Ecosystem services is like many great ideas. It's a tremendous motivator. It's a good way of thinking about a problem. It's a good way of drawing to the attention of policymakers the natural environment is important. It's a reminder to business the natural environment is important and provides them with lots of services. But in the last analysis, it's the analysis that's difficult.
Thank you, Jonathan Aylin. Kelvin, have you spoken to anyone else along these lines?
I've actually spoken to a couple of environmental economists who have a slightly different point of view, as you might expect. Dr. Philip Cooper from Bath University thinks that broad valuations of nature are useful, but again, limited. He seems to think that, you know, whilst you can use these techniques at smaller scales, say to value a small local woodland where it might work, you can't then just scale that up into a regional, a national, or indeed, as many people try, a global valuation. It just doesn't work. He also added something really interesting, and that was that sometimes there's no harm in actually putting a value on something. In a poor country, for example, recognising that that wildlife has value, there's no harm in that country then asking the richer nations who want to preserve it to actually pay for it.
Now, with me here is the leading environmentalist and writer Tony Juniper and Professor Bill Adams from the Department of Geography at Cambridge University. Tony, there is a kind of instinctive, knee-jerk response that we are losing something if we try and value nature in economic terms. Is that a reasonable thing, or is that holding us back?
One thing we're losing is nature. And one of the reasons we're losing nature is because we're not putting sufficient value on it. And one of the things that I've observed over the many years that I've been campaigning for nature to be treated with a longer-term view in mind is that how there are multiple values simultaneously at stake. Some of them are intrinsic in the sense of nature being beautiful and worth protecting for its own sake. We see nature as having spiritual values, as having scientific values, and that is really how we've been trying to take the debate into politics and the public over the years. Trouble is, it's not sufficient, and we do need to add more weight to the kind of arguments we're bringing to attention, and that's why I've been very interested in looking at some of the recent work on economic valuation, because I think for many policymakers in particular, they see a choice between ecology and economy, and generally put economy above ecology without understanding that they're sacrificing values that aren't on the balance sheet. So making those values visible, I think, could have real political impact.
Bill, one tends to focus this on animals and living organisms, but how does this work with landscape? I mean, how does a geographer view this?
Well, I guess a geographer is used to trying to see things from quite a wide interdisciplinary perspective. So interested in things like water services, particularly, as well as those from living nature. Some people talk about ecosystem services as if one had the option to value it or not value it. And in a sense, that isn't true because we have a system, a market system, which places values on it. It just doesn't place a proper value or a sensible value on it. If a company, for example, pollutes and doesn't get asked to clean it up, they're essentially getting a service for free
and the cost of that is paid somewhere else by the person who has to clean it up or suffer the pollution. So it's not that we don't value nature in our present system, it's that we don't place a proper value on it. And that's not to say the present system is the best. It just is the system we operate in. That's capitalism. That's our neoliberal world. We put a price on everything. And if then we don't price nature at all, then essentially you're setting a zero price on it, which is why it gets degraded, or one of the reasons why it gets degraded.
I mean, it's one of the problems that we can't afford it.
One of the other distinctions we have to make when we're conjuring with these kinds of numbers is the difference between making a valuation and then putting a price on the natural asset that's been valued and then taking the next step and putting it into a market. Very often, the valuation may not lead to a price or indeed a market. It might lead to a regulation. For example, the recent discussion over the neonicotinoid pesticides that are believed to be killing bee populations, we took that into the political discussion, understood the market value that's being provided by bees in the sense of food production and everything else, but we didn't make a bee market. What we did was to ban the pesticides. So the valuation doesn't necessarily take you into a world of putting nature into the marketplace. It does give you the opportunity, however, to see what's being lost through the present direction of travel and to correct that. And sometimes it might be right to place some kind of market out there. And I'm one of the people who would say that we should have a global carbon market. We should be pricing that particular problem and we should be getting people to pay for it. But other things we can't. And so we just need to be getting the values, I would say, bringing them into a discussion and deciding what the best tool is to be able to keep those values and protect them.
This has so far been quite abstract, and we've talked about cost and value and worth. But are there any examples where people have actually costed, where it's probably too late to do it, but then the clean-up operation, I mean, we talked about polluting beaches or losing species, that really can be pinned down in financial terms?
Well, one example that I talk about in my book is the extinction of the gastric brooding frogs, which had evolved a mechanism whereby they could host their tadpoles in their stomach. Some physiologists were very interested to notice that the tadpoles weren't being digested and believed that the frogs had evolved some chemical to protect them. They thought this might be very valuable in the treatment of peptic ulcers. Had that been the case, it might have led to a very substantial market and a new drug. Unfortunately, the new drug couldn't be developed because the frogs went extinct. And so those kinds of examples are all around us all the time. We're losing value, and we're not noticing we're losing value because it's invisible on anyone's balance sheet.
So in a sense, we're in a particular moment when we have the science and the knowledge to measure that destruction, and we're starting to ask questions about what, if anything, we should do about it. And the engine of that is capitalism. It's the way markets work. And so it's an obvious question as to how markets value nature. And as Tony says, we haven't valued it very well. The difficult question he raises is what happens when you do start to talk about nature in terms of its economic value. You said in your introduction, when you hand nature over to the commodity trader. Well, quite. What happens when you do, or if you do? And that's a very interesting and challenging question, I think.
Well, let's try and answer it. What does happen?
I repeat my point about the extent to which we don't necessarily have to finish up in a market that once we've understood the economic value, it changes the conversation.
So I do have a worry about this, which is that it is a bit of a Pandora's box, that once you start valuing nature in this explicitly economistic way, that everything flies out, and I'm not sure that we can handle the results very well. So that's my worry about this
it
way
is,
of thinking.
No, I agree with that, Bill, but the point I would make is that we're still at quite an early stage of this, and it's really, really important that we have these debates so that we can correct any of these failures as we begin to unpack Pandora's box and all these things start flying out, some of which may fly into our face in a very unpleasant way. So I'm absolutely with you in the sense that we need to keep an eye on the risks, but I think if we let the risks determine that we don't do this, I think we'll be in a worse place than if we do it.
And Bill, one of the things that we can measure and are particularly pertinent is the fact that we've got 200,000 extra people on this planet every day and less room and increased footprint by default, as well as varying from country to country. I mean, that affects the whole argument too, in just we don't have space.
I think the way in which the ecosystem service argument contributes to that thinking is I think it throws the attention on aspects of the environment which have been taken for granted before. And I think if you sit in a country like Britain and you think about nature, you think about sort of Wordsworth's nature, beautiful landscapes and wild birds, which we love. But you also have to think how this argument works in the Ganges Valley or in the middle of the Sahel, and what nature means in those places where people are often living in a very exposed way to environmental variability. And I think when you do that, it makes quite a lot of sense to start to try and understand the ways in which we're multiply dependent on natural systems, natural services. And actually, I'm not so bothered by what the previous interviewer said about the difficulty of pulling bits out and turning them into markets. He's right that it is a whole, but we need to make a proper engagement between our markets and the way we organise ourselves socially and economically and the way we understand nature. We have to understand that relationship. And there's lots of environmental economists doing great work, but we're still at an early stage, and it's really urgent that we get that relationship clearly understood, and not just in universities, but out there on the street and in business boardrooms and indeed in government.
I mean, looking at this from the other way, are we overvaluing already some aspects of nature?
The attention has historically been on the charismatic, big, colourful animals that you can communicate easily through TV and everything else. The thing we've probably underestimated most is the really small things, the microorganisms that are replenishing soil fertility and the plankton that are putting free oxygen into the atmosphere, soaking up CO2 and making it rain, as well as being the basis of the marine food chains. Those are the bits we've probably most underestimated. Isn't that what you say, Bill?
Yeah, no, I agree, Tony. And I think that what is interesting is that there are some bits that are much more easily seen as a market. There is a market for wildlife tourism, and there is a market for bird watching and all sorts of things. So some bits have a market wrapped around them already. And there, if there is a danger, it is that that will be taken as the value of nature. And all the other bits, which require quite a lot of science to understand and which are, you know, ugly and smelly, but deliver the kind of world that we need to live in, those bits get forgotten. So there is, if you like, a risk that we'll go off half-cocked with ecosystem services, only valuing the bits that wealthy people value. And that won't do at all. That could even be worse than we are, a situation we're in already.
Well, Tony Juniper and Bill Adams, thank you very much indeed. Thank
you.
And thanks, as ever, to Kelvin Boot. It seems that it is worth costing nature and putting a hard price on it, even if it's only to make people sit up and pay attention to the value of the natural world. Now you can get more information about today's programme by going to the Radio 4 website and following the links to Share Planet. As nature is clearly so useful, as well as aesthetically, spiritually and emotionally important, can we encourage it in our daily urban lives, which can easily feel completely cut off from the natural world? So next week we'll be looking at building wildlife into our cities and towns rather than it being something remote and out there, and asking how we can design our living spaces to encourage it to be right here. Until then, goodbye.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.